Thank you, Chong, for this opportunity. Thank you all for coming. So I decided to tell you two different stories. Initially, I was planning just to tell you about bosonization and the sheer sound of metals. But I have decided to rather tell you two different stories. So the first story is going to be about some recent insights that we have developed for understanding nonlinear transport and its connection to Berry phases. And then we're gonna switch gears and talk about these ideas of bosonization and the shear sound of metals. Basically, I'll try to introduce some proposal for understanding and also measuring a new type of collective mode in metals. And this work with this gentleman, so this is my student, Oles, who is the one who did the part of the nonlinear hole. And these are postdocs and visiting scientists at the Institute in Dresden. So this slide is a summary of the key ideas I want to convey in this first part. So I want to convince you that in metals in which break inversion symmetry display a type of violation to Newton's second law, in the sense that these metals can display an acceleration. These electron liquids can display an acceleration that scales with the square of the applied force, with the square of the electric field. And this acceleration, we call it the nonlinear Hall acceleration, because it's an acceleration that is always orthogonal to the applied force. And the condition is basically you have to break inversion symmetry for this to be present. And I'll show you that this acceleration is controlled by some quantum geometric object that we call the Berry curvature dipole. That Berry curvature dipole is the average of the gradient of the Berry curvature with respect to momentum over the occupied states. And I will try to convince you that this Berry curvature dipole is responsible for a type of nonlinear Hall effect, for a kind of nonlinear Hall effect that can be present in materials even in the presence of time reversal symmetry. And then I'll try to present a very interesting SAM rule that we found relating the Berry phase geometry of the bands and the nonlinear conductivity of metals. So I'll show you that the second order conductivity of metals that measures rectification, so a conductivity that measures, you know, how much DC light you get when you shine some AC electric field, when you integrate this quantity, even though the exact shape of this function depends on band energies, the integral is independent of band energies. It only depends on the Berry connection of the band structure. And all of this is done for essentially non-interacting electrons, but I'll try to comment why some aspects of it will survive. It's natural to expect that they'll survive in the presence of interactions. So just to briefly remind you about the Drude weight. So the Drude weight is one of the central concepts in our theory of metals. The Drude weight basically tries to answer the question to what happens to Newton's second law in a metal. So if you had some ideal limit in which there was no impurities and you applied an electric field, instead of having Ohm's law, you will see that the electrons actually accelerate. And the proportionality between this acceleration of the electron liquid and the applied force is measured by the Drude weight. So the Drude weight is kind of an inverse inertia of the electron liquid. In practice, you know, of course, metals always have impurities, so they will eventually settle into a steady state in which they are not accelerating the electrons, but they just have a finite velocity, and this gives you the resistivity. But the importance of the Drude weight, in a sense, is that it separates the inertia of the electron liquid from the friction that the electrons are experiencing. So the conductivity is contaminated by the friction, but the Drude weight, in a sense, distills the information of the inertia of the electron liquid. And so it's, in a sense, a more fundamental quantity. And so, you know, in practice, the way you will compute the Drude weight for a metal, if there is a good separation between the intraband processes and the interband processes, you will compute this inertia of the electron liquid by integrating the conductivity as a function of frequency. So the Drude weight is a kind of residue of this Drude pole of the metal, and that will be a measure of the inertia that is essentially independent of disorder, at least in the weakly disordered limit.
E.T.?
Yeah?
Can you remind me somewhere there in these cardinal events?
Is the sound rule what?
Does it need the cardinal events?
No. So, you know, Galilean invariance has implications for the Drude weight. So, for example, Galilean invariance implies that the Drude weight does not renormalize from the one you would have for free fermions. But this is the general definition of Drude weight if you have a metal. So you will integrate this Drude peak, and that will measure basically what is the Drude weight of the metal, which, you know, might depend on interactions. It might even depend on disorder in principle. In the case of Galilean fermions, it will not renormalize. But here is just the general definition of Drude weight. Right, so I'm going to revisit basically Newton's law in a Bloch band, okay? To revisit what happens with the acceleration. So very briefly to remind you, so the way we're gonna do this is we're gonna construct the position operator projected into a Bloch band, okay? And then we're just going to compute the time derivative of the position operator with the Hamiltonian and then the second time derivative. So let me briefly remind you how to construct the position operator projected into a Bloch band. So, you know, in vacuum, the position operator is just the gradient with respect to momentum. If you project into a Bloch band, so let's imagine, you know, you have an isolated Bloch band with some dispersion, epsilon, and some crystal momentum, so it's living in a Brillouin zone. So we want to project the position operator there. You will find it's made up of two pieces. So one piece looks like in vacuum, so it's just the gradient with respect to crystal momentum. And the other piece of the position operator is nothing else than the Berry connection, the Abelian-Berry connection. And so the fact that there is an extra piece in Bloch bands has a very important consequence, which is the position operators along different directions no longer commute. So the quantity that measures this lack of commutativity of the position operators is the Berry curvature. So this is a very nice way to understand Berry curvature as an operator. So it's basically an operator that is diagonal in crystal momentum and locally measures how much positions lack commutativity. And it has very important consequences for transport. So let's couple this Bloch band to an electric field. So we can couple it in this gauge, E dot R. And so let's compute the velocity operator projected into the velocity operator defined as the rate of change of this projected position operator. So then it's just basically like, you know, two lines of algebra to show that the velocity operator has an extra piece in addition to the one you would find in vacuum. So in vacuum, you will have some group velocity, which is the gradient of the dispersion with respect to crystal momentum. And here, because of this lack of commutativity of positions, you get an extra piece, the so-called anomalous velocity. So this is the statement for the operator, the projected velocity operator. So, you know, this is very nice because in this way of doing it in an operator construction, you can do it very quickly. And so this gives you the same result that, you know, you can derive using semi-classics like in this classic treatments by Chan Yu. So then you find this extra piece that goes like omega cross E, and this is the part that is responsible for the anomalous Hall effect, the conventional linear anomalous Hall effect in materials that break time reversal symmetry. So let's now consider the acceleration operator. So basically what we are doing here is taking the commutator of this velocity operator that I just introduced with the Hamiltonian to compute the rate of change. And so what you will find is that the acceleration operator is made up of three pieces. There is nothing else. It's not like, you know, a series. It's exactly just made out of three pieces. And it stops at second order in electric field. I mean, this is just in the limit of a single block math. So the first piece is just the usual Newton's law. So it's proportional to the applied force times the effective mass, the second derivative of the dispersion. Then there is another piece that is just sort of the instantaneous rate of change of the anomalous velocity. So if you have like an electric field that changes in time, this will give an instantaneous rate of change to the anomalous velocity that gives you this extra term. But there is a third term that scales like the square of the electric field. And the coefficient that controls the relation between acceleration and electric fields is the gradient of the Berry curvature with respect to momentum. So this is this term that I was mentioning that we call the nonlinear Hall acceleration. So what I'm going to do next is to show you that this nonlinear Hall acceleration can give rise to a type of Hall effect, an analog of a Hall effect, but which is nonlinear, in which the current scales with the square of the electric field, but is allowed in time reversal invariant materials. So here, I'm first going to give you the answer sort of in a very simple-minded fashion, just to kind of give you intuition. You can get this same answer from Boltzmann or from more sophisticated treatments, but just to kind of give you intuition. So let's compute the currents. So the currents are just the, you know, the expectation value of the velocity operator over the occupied states. And let's imagine, you know, that the electrons are subject to some scattering mechanism that eventually brings the distribution function into some new steady state distribution in the presence of the electric field, which roughly speaking is just the equilibrium distribution function shifted by some amount that is just controlled by the scattering rate. You basically will get the same result if you do Boltzmann. So this is essentially Boltzmann theory. So let's do then an expansion of this in powers of E. So first order, you'll get the usual, you know, Drude result plus the usual anomalous Hall effect. To second order, then you get two terms. So you get a semi-classical term that doesn't know about the Berry curvature, and then you get this extra term that scales with the square of the electric field, and that is controlled by this average over occupied states of this gradient of the Berry curvature. So this quantity we call the Berry curvature dipole, this average of the Berry curvature. But notice that this conductivity knows about tau, so it's proportional to the scattering rate. So this is basically how we understood this effect a few years ago with Liang Fu. But so basically, the story that I'm telling you now about this interpretation of viewing this effect as a nonlinear Hall acceleration is trying to go a bit deeper into the meaning of this quantity. So, you know, what I'm trying to say in a sense is that the reason in the conductivity you get tau is because this quantity, this Berry curvature dipole, should be viewed as a type of Drude weight. So the intrinsic part is the Drude weight, but in the conductivity in which you need to determine the final terminal velocity of electrons, then the nonlinear Hall effect again is a bit contaminated by the scattering mechanism. In the same sense as the linear conductivity contains the Drude weight and also the scattering rate.
Presumably for an insulator that D vanishes?
Yes. So I'm just about to say that in this slide. Yes. So very good. So what is this quantity about? So what are the conditions for it to be non-zero generic? Let's say. It's basically two conditions. So the system has to be a metal, and it has to break inversion symmetry. So this nonlinear Hall effect is an effect that is about metals. It's not like the quantized Hall effect that is for insulators. And you know, this makes sense from the point of view that this quantity is a type of nonlinear through the weight. You know, insulators should not have accelerations in the presence of electric fields, and this is why it vanishes in a sense. But yeah, it's very easy to see that it vanishes because it's the integral of a gradient, so its average over the entire Brillouin zone, if you have an insulator, will vanish by the periodicity of the Brillouin zone. And it has to be a metal that breaks inversion symmetry because all second order conductivities are vanished in the presence of inversion symmetry.
Same
thing? Yeah.
So why does the quasi particle with specific momentum k care about the whole average of the?
Oh, very good. So, you know, this is one way to put the formula, but maybe a way that makes it more manifest that is Fermi liquid property is to put this derivative on the distribution function. So you can rewrite the formula by taking the derivative on the distribution function, and it will be an average of the gradient of f times omega. And in that case, it will be manifest that it's a Fermi surface property. So it's a Fermi surface property only present also for metals, because it measures a kind of acceleration, as I was trying to say at the beginning. So insulators should not have accelerations in the presence of forces. But you know, a way to state that, to make that same statement but in a slightly more interesting way, is to say that this quantity, this Berry curvature dipole, is basically an order parameter for broken inversion symmetry in metals. You know, it's very hard to this is a nice statement from a practical point of view, because it's very hard to have measurable practical ways to characterize broken inversion symmetry in metals, because the polarization, which is the natural order parameter for insulators, is hard to measure in metals. Sometimes it's even not well defined in metals, because charges are free to flow. So you tend to screen the free charges that would appear at the boundaries of an insulator if you were to measure polarization. Whereas this is a quantity that knows about the transport in the metal. It's characterizing a type of anomalous acceleration in the metal. So it's a metallic quantity. So from a practical point of view, it's an interesting quantity because in a sense serves as an order parameter for breaking inversion symmetry in metals.
So what is confusing is that if I create a quasi particle with a well-defined position and momentum, the semi-classical limit,
mm-hmm.
and in the non-interacting limit, the motion of this quasi particle only cares about the local property in space and momentum space as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So why does it see the average Berry curvature dipole? I mean,
So here is, yeah, so good. So one thing is the total current. So the total current, will contain the average. But each quasi particle, you know, here maybe
okay.
There is no averages. So each quasi particle, it's seeing its own acceleration in a sense
okay.
that is controlled locally by what is the gradient of the Berry curvature.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask again?
Yeah.
So. Suppose I don't know band theories, I don't know
mm-hmm.
anything about
mm-hmm.
omega. Can I just, by staring at that the bottom line here, and conclude that for an insulator that D should always vanish? Is there
You mean like conceptually, you mean, or?
Suppose I don't have single particle approximation. Is there a general argument saying that D vector should always vanish for an insulator?
So you know, for an insulator, I expect that there is no acceleration in the presence of an electric field.
Uh-huh.
So you know,
okay.
The insulator should not accelerate in the presence of an electric field because the charge is bound. Insulators can have at most currents in the presence of electric field, Hall currents.
Right.
right? But no accelerations.
I see. Okay.
All right. Yeah. So, right. So let's try to kind of understand this a bit, how this Berry dipole looks like in a specific example. So let's consider a two-dimensional metal that has a Fermi surface that looks like this. And imagine this material has some mirror symmetry so that the Berry curvature on this half of the Fermi surface is positive, on this half is negative. Yeah?
Just going back to Chong's previous question.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose now I know a little bit of the band theory. I know there are bands, but I don't know too much. I know there are two bands. One of the lower band is completely filled, and the upper band is completely empty. Now, if I add a small electric field, in principle, I can excite a little bit electrons from the lower band to the upper band and have some current.
Yeah, so you know, in all these arguments, I projected into a single band, right? So in a sense, the assumption is if you have more than one band, anything that I'm doing, I have to do it sufficiently slow compared to the separation of the bands so that I don't produce interband transitions.
So
otherwise, I need to consider the two bands initially, right?
So if you only have a single band, then your many body wave function already cannot change.
No, but I'm allowed to have a chemical potential. I'm allowed to have a Fermi surface.
Suppose,
if you have a single band, then nothing changes. So
if you really have an insulator with a single band, then there's nothing to change.
Yeah.
Then of course you wouldn't induce more current.
Of course you would.
By adding electrical field, you will not have more current.
No, so if you have an insulator, a Chern insulator, and you have an electric field, it will have a current. It's just orthogonal to the applied electric field. Right?
If I only have a single band?
Yes. And then the statement is, if the band is completely filled, I don't know any way that an insulator would accelerate in an electric field. It can have a velocity, but not an acceleration.
Yeah.
Accelerations, I'm trying to claim, are properties of metals in weak electric, you know, ignoring all interband processes, basically.
So in the Chern insulator, in order to have the current, I need to have the other band.
In what sense? I mean, a Chern insulator will have a current in the presence of an electric field that is orthogonal to the applied electric field.
If I have the other band, yes, but if I only have a single band, then my many body wave function is completely fixed. Why would the electric field do anything?
I think there it has to do with the definition of current operator.
Yeah, you have to revisit the definition of the current operator. So you know, basically when you go to this band and you have forgotten how the band comes from, you have already projected into this band, then the current operator has an extra piece, which is basically the same piece of the velocity operator in the presence of the electric field. So it's a piece that is not there if the electric field is zero.
I'm just asking the simplest question. Suppose I only have a single band with all the block states filled.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm not able to change the many body states without changing the electron number.
It's a bit tricky. So, you know, when you apply an electric field, if you do it in the gauge in which you're coupling it with a vector potential, you know, there is really slow motion, right? So the states are, you know, the K is growing with the electric field, right? So, you know, every state is kind of going to the other state over some, there is some motion, right? The vector potential depends on time. So if you do it in that gauge, there is some motion. And in this gauge in which you're coupling to the position operator, then that shows up as a correction to the current operator.
So basically saying, when I change the electrical field, although I say I have only a single band, my states are somehow really changing.
some sense, yes.
Yeah, let's chat about this offline.
It's, you know, a churn insulator, right? The whole effect, what is the conductivity of a churn insulator? It's finite, right? So it doesn't matter how large is the gap to the other band. Basically that same statement, right? So, yeah, so this effect was recently observed experimentally by two groups, the group of Kim Fai Mak at Cornell and the group of Pablo Jarillo Herrero at MIT. And so basically they took a bilayer of transition metal that chalcogenides. This is the top view of that material. It has a single mirror line. So it has these conditions for this very simple toy model that I mentioned that has, you know, it's a metal, so it has, this is a cartoon. I mean, the band structure is a bit more complicated, but it has one half of a Fermi surface with positive Berry curvature and the other half with negative Berry curvature. And yeah, so by the way, this is the reason why we call it Berry dipole, because it's sort of a measure of the dipolar distribution of the Berry curvature over the occupied states. So these are, for example, results in a whole bar geometry. So you're driving current between these two contacts. And the red dots, for example, are where you measure the voltage in between these whole contacts. And these dots are when you measure it between the longitudinal contacts. Something that is useful in experiment is that because it's a second order effect, if you drive the electric field at omega, you will get a response at 2 omega. So that can be useful for filtering the second order response from the linear response. And also in this experiment, they constructed some device with a lot of contacts. So that allowed them to verify also the angular dependence of the effect. So the effect has some particular angular dependence because the effect knows about the orientation of the electric field relative to this gradient of the Berry curvature in the material. So this is the typical angular dependence one expects. And here, these dots are experimental data, and the dashed line is what you fit from that theoretical formula. So it seems to fit at least the simple picture.
Do you also have steady current?
There again?
Steric
current. Static.
Yeah, only like zero current.
Yes, you also have rectified current.
And has been seen in experiment.
This has been seen not in these earlier experiments, but in the most recent experiments, I think it has been seen. Yeah, so you have 2 omega and at zero. Right, so what I showed you is kind of the simple single band limit, sort of that makes simpler to understand the conceptual aspects of the effect. So, but what we did more recently with my student was to develop general theory of second order response effects. So this is, let me just make a quick advertising about use of gauges. So you know, most of the calculations of linear response theory of conductivities, for example, people tend to compute using basically Pyrrhus substitution. So you just put the electric field with the vector potential being time dependent and then you do, you know, J dot J correlators and compute conductivities out of current correlators. There is another gauge that is not that widely used, but it's much more convenient for doing higher order responses, which is this so-called length gauge, which, you know, I was using in the arguments. So basically you can find the representation of the position operator in a multi-band system, and the representation is similar to the one that I sketched before, except that instead of the abelian Berry connection, you have the non-abelian Berry connection. And so what this gauge is useful because then you can compute the conductivity simply as a correlator, directly as a correlator of a drive and the response that you're interested in. You don't have to do JJ, you know, subtract diamagnetic parts, and take 1 over omega as one does in the other gauges, which becomes much more cumbersome when one starts going to second order. So this one, you know, the conductivity is just correlator of velocity and position. And if you're careful enough, you know, you can show that this produces exactly the same answers as the conventional gauge. So it's just a different gauge. And so this is the entire formula for the second order conductivity. So this formula contains, you know, all effects in principle, all band structure effects, you know, second harmonic generation, shift current, photo galvanic effects. It can work for insulators and metals. So we in a sense were able to unify a lot of different phenomena within a single formula. And it's a very simple-minded formula in terms of how you describe the relaxation processes. So we're just using basically a relaxation time, a quantum relaxation time approximation. So, you know, if you want to understand disorder, you know, details of the disorder corrections to these effects are certainly beyond this formalism, but at least the simple intraband Drude type, any intraband effect that can be modeled in some kind of Drude type relaxation should be captured by this. And so here is some really interesting result we found that I actually was not expecting when we started looking at this. So you know, my motivation was, you know, since I was saying this Berry curvature dipole measures a kind of nonlinear Drude weight, let's see what would be its appearance in a some rule like the one you have for the linear conductivity. And so what we found is a much more general result that applies not just to the intraband part, but it also applies to the interband parts of the nonlinear conductivity. So the state, let me give you the statement. So the statement is as follows. So if you take the general second order conductivity of any material that has time reversal symmetry, that's the only key assumption, that it's time reversal invariant, and you compute the rectification conductivity. So when these two frequencies are omega and minus omega, which gives you basically the DC current that you have when you shine light, and you integrate that over frequency, you get a quantity that is completely independent of the band energies. It just depends on the Berry connection. So just to remind you, you know, so the actual conductivity depends on the group velocities of the bands, on the band energies. So the spectral distribution that we're integrating actually will change as you change the band energies, but the integral, the spectral weight, seems to be completely independent of the band energies. It only knows about the Berry connection. So we call it the quantum rectification sum rule. And so let me tell you what the different terms, where the different terms come from. So it's basically two terms. Okay, so if you plot this spectral weight for a typical insulator, you will find two kinds of terms. There is one term that is basically a delta, is coming from a delta function-like peak near zero frequency. And all of the other terms are coming from frequencies above the threshold for interband transitions. So the term that comes from this delta function peak is this Berry curvature dipole that I have been talking about. So this Berry curvature dipole exhausts the spectral weight within the band. But also the interband part gives rise to some other part in the SAM rule that doesn't care about band energies, just about Berry connections. So it's a very interesting result in that,
So for the usual Drude weight, if I extend the integration range to the interband region,
yes,
I presumably get some expression. You're saying, yes. Is there any way to cast it into some nicer form?
Not that I know. So in the usual case, you have some sum rules. If you have Galilean invariance, you might prove that the entire spectral weight equals the bare
right.
mass.
Right.
Things
Supposed
like that.
That.
Things like that. Right. Yeah, but in general, I don't know of analogous statements in that case.
I see. So somehow this is even nicer.
Yeah, this is very nice in a sense. Yeah, so In three dimensions, also it's worth noting that this right-hand side is actually dimensionless. You know, it's cubic in the Berry connections, so it has the same units of the theta term, basically, in terms of units. So three dimensions seems to be special for this sum rule in some way, although I don't have any kind of very deep way to understand it, but at least just from units, the right-hand side of the sum rule is dimensionless in three dimensions. But in general, the sum rule applies to any dimension. Right, so let me then quickly, so time is there, very good. So let me mention maybe a little bit the behavior of Biel semimetals as a platform for this type of effects. So Biel semimetals are interesting platforms. They, for example, the Berry curvature dipole in 3D would be a tensor. So the trace of a Berry curvature dipole will measure just the divergence of the Berry curvature. So it measures, if you have an isolated Biel node, the trace of this Berry dipole would measure the Biel charge. So quantized in some fundamental units. So the trace of the Berry dipole for a Biel node is sort of quantized. The issue is, of course, you know, in a real material, in a real band structure, you will have Biel nodes appearing in pairs. So the trace of the Berry dipole in the entire Brillouin zone will vanish, but it will vanish from the different, you know, cancellations of the different Biel points. And so here, for example, is the response of Biel semimetals to circularly polarized light. You'll get some DC current, and now we can unify, you know, the interband processes that people had described before with our Berry dipole, which is this little peak near omega equals zero in a single formula. So we have a very nice way to describe crossover of interband and intraband processes. Let me maybe skip this. It's just a prediction. There is no experimentalist in the room, right? This is a sales pitch, so no. So for experimentalists, so let's just skip it. All right, so yeah, so just to summarize this part, metals that break inversion symmetry have a correction to Newton's law in the sense that they have accelerations that scale with this applied, the square of the applied electric field, and that are orthogonal to the applied electric field, and they are controlled by this quantity that we call the Berry curvature dipole, which is the gradient of the Berry curvature over occupied states, which controls or gives rise to a type of nonlinear version of the Hall effect, even when you have time reversal symmetry. And for time reversal invariant materials, the integral of the rectification conductivity is a quantity that depends only on the Berry connections and the area of the peak. There is a single peak near zero frequency whose area is the Berry dipole. So in a sense, the Berry dipole plays very naturally a role of a nonlinear version of the Drude weight. So that's that for that part. So maybe if there is questions, any other question about that part? Otherwise, let me try to tell you this story a bit quicker. Yes, so this story is about a proposal for a new type of collective mode in strongly interacting metals, okay? So the idea is that certain metals, so just to give you kind of a summary of the ideas before we describe them in some detail. So the idea is that certain metals, in addition to the sort of textbook collective mode that they can have, which is the plasma mode, can display an extra collective mode that behaves like a transverse sound. As you know, transverse sound is a property in classical systems, is a property of solids. So solids will have longitudinal sound and will have transverse sound because they can have a finite shear modulus. So you don't expect them to be there in liquids. But so what I'll show you is that actually Fermi liquids, certain Fermi liquids, beyond certain, when their mass renormalizes beyond certain threshold, develop a sharp collective mode that exits the continuum, the particle hole continuum, so behaves like a sharp collective mode. And so the problem is this mode is transverse, so how to measure it? So I'm gonna briefly present to you some two strategies that might help experimentalists detect this mode in correlated metals. One is I'll show you some resonant dips that appear in the conductance of narrow channels. And another trick that might help observe this unconventional collective mode is to turn on weak magnetic fields that actually mix the mode with the density. So this might allow to detect the mode using, for example, near field techniques like the ones that people have used to detect plasmons in graphene. Yeah, so very, very quickly, a very brief introduction to Landau-Fermi liquid theory. So Landau-Fermi liquid theory, one of its central assumptions is that the Fermi surface is an object that makes sense locally in space and time. So it's a kind of string, if you wish. The Landau-Fermi liquid theory is, in a sense, a classical string theory, in the sense that it's a theory of the fluctuations of an extended object, the shape of a Fermi surface. So if you open up a textbook on Landau-Fermi liquid theory, then you'll see Landau-Fermi liquid theory comes basically equipped with two pieces of information. So one of them is the energy functional, the Landau energy functional, which measures, you know, the energy deviations of the Fermi radius away from equilibrium. It's a bilinear energy functional containing the Landau parameters and the renormalized Fermi velocity. And it also comes with the kinetic equation, which is telling you what are the dynamics of these weak fluctuations of the shape of a Fermi surface. And also, you know, you have some prescription for physical operators. You know, for example, the density will be just the area of this shape at any point in space and time. But something that maybe is not often emphasized in textbooks is that there is a canonical underlying structure to Landau-Fermi liquid theory. So you can basically promote this Landau energy functional to be a Hamiltonian, and you can introduce a Poisson algebra for Fermi radius operators so that given this energy functional, you reproduce the kinetic equation as the dynamics for the Fermi radius. And so this is a point that has been recently emphasized by Son. This particular point of view, starting from the classical Landau-Fermi liquid theory. And so the natural next step after you have realized there is, you know, a canonical structure is to quantize. So, you know, we do the usual thing, we replace Poisson brackets by commutators and promote now the classical variables into operators. And so you end up with some algebra for the radius, for the Fermi radius operator in higher dimensions, for the commutators of the Fermi radius operator.
I'm sorry.
Yep.
What's the Poisson bracket about?
So the Poisson bracket is, you know, sort of a very simple exercise. So if I give you the Landau kinetic equation and the Landau energy functional, you know, I can compute the time derivative of PF as Hamiltonian times Poisson bracket of Hamiltonian with PF, right? So this is the Poisson bracket that you have to choose so that you get these dynamics given this Hamiltonian. So it's just a different way of writing the usual classical Landau-Fermi liquid theory, but in a way that immediately suggests, you know, how to go to a quantum case. So if you just do that, you know, let's promote everything to quantum following the usual route. Then you find this algebra of operators, and what you recover is basically the bosonization theory of the Fermi surface. So it's basically a very quick path to arrive at the bosonization description of Fermi liquids. So in 1D, so if you just follow this prescription that I describe in 1D, you know, the Fermi radius will be just 2 points, right? So you just need 2 fields, basically classically. So suppose you literally take, you know, classical 1D kinetic equation and you quantize it following this prescription. So what you will find is that the quantized 1D Fermi liquid is not a Landau Fermi liquid, but it's a Lattinger liquid. So it gives you the proper description of the Lattinger liquid in higher dimensions. So this energy functional, which is the same Landau energy functional plus the commutation relations that you have here, are basically, you know, the cast-moving commutation relations that you have in 1D bosonization. So the quantized 1D Landau Fermi liquid is a Lattinger liquid. So what happens in higher dimensions? So this was basically a debate in the early 90s, because Anderson basically challenged the notion of Landau Fermi liquid theory in two dimensions. So people followed this analysis to try to see really what happens with Fermi liquids in higher dimensions. So I just showed you, this quantized version of Fermi liquid in 1D is a Lattinger liquid. So what if maybe in higher dimensions you also ran away from the Landau Fermi liquid low energy description? And so what you have to do in higher dimensions then is to solve the problem, you will have to introduce an infinite number of fields, because you have theta.
Sorry, can you go back?
Yep.
So in this 1D example, how do you know the electron operator is something that you
use? You don't know. Yeah, so up to here, you don't know the electron operator.
So in this sense, just doing this is incomplete.
It is incomplete in some sense. So you have to provide it with the electron operator. Yeah. This is essentially a description. Yeah, I mean, fixing the electron operator is not so hard. So it's almost like, you have to construct an operator that locally adds charge one, anti-commutes. So yeah, it's not so hard to fix the electron operator, but it's missing up to here. Yeah. So what you have to do in higher dimensions is introduce all these fields to parameterize the fluctuations of the Fermi surface. So a useful basis is to decompose the Fermi radius into angular momentum channels. So the different harmonics of the deformation of the Fermi surface. And so basically you will have an infinite series of bosonic fields. So, the density, the L equal plus minus one harmonics will describe the current of the Fermi liquid, and higher harmonics will describe higher deformations. And so what you can show actually is that the problem can be solved exactly. So you can find all the excitations in the Fermi liquid, the collective modes, and the incoherent excitations. And so basically what happens is the problem maps, you can map it essentially into a tight binding chain. It really finding the eigenstates maps literally to finding a tight binding chain, solving a tight binding chain in this space of angular momentum operators. The Landau parameters appear essentially in this picture as bond disorder between the different sites in the chain. So the problem, in the absence of Landau parameters, it looks like a translational invariant chain, and the Landau parameters play the role of some local bond disorder between some specific angular momentum channels. So what you will find generically is two types of solutions. So there will be bound solutions to these impurity bonds. So those will be solutions that are localized in angular momentum channels. So they are essentially made of a few of these deformations of a Fermi surface up to exponential localization. Those will be the collective modes, like the zero sound. And you will also find other types of solution to the chain that are delocalized plane waves, and they will make the particle hole continue. So in a sense, what happens in higher dimension is that the static correlation functions of the electron liquid are dominated, by the low energy part of the modes, which are basically the particle hole continuum. And these plane waves are weakly affected by the Landau parameters. So this is maybe a slightly different way to try to understand why the Landau Fermi liquid remains stable in higher dimensions. But it immediately makes it natural that there should not be just one collective mode. In a sense, all the, There is no reason why there should be only one collective mode. There could be more than one collective mode because the problem maps into finding bound states near these bonds. So, you know, what you can show, one of the simplest modes that appears is this shear sound. So this mode is a linearly dispersing mode in addition to the zero sound. It remains linearly dispersing even when you add Coulomb interactions because it's a neutral mode. It's a mode that doesn't have weight on the density. It only has weight on the current and higher operators. And so it looks like a transverse shear wave in a solid, except that you have a liquid. So in a sense, you know, the Fermi liquid is still a liquid, but the vanishing of the shear modulus is a property really of the low energy, of the static correlation functions. So in a sense, when you probe the liquid at some ratio of omega over Q, it looks like a solid, but the static correlation from the point of view of omega going to zero first, it will look like a liquid. But in this dynamical regime, it can look like a solid with a sharp collective mode. That's one way to think about it. So it has this shear sound. So you can solve, what we did was to solve this chain with F0, F1 Landau parameters. And so what you find is that for this mode to exit the particle Hall continuum, it requires some threshold. So F1 needs to be larger than one, unlike the zero sound. So the zero sound, as soon as you make F0 finite, it immediately exits the continuum. So it's there for even infinitesimally interacting Landau Fermi liquids. But this transverse sound requires certain threshold of interactions. It has to be beyond certain interaction strength. But it's not such a large interaction strength. So when you turn this into renormalization of quasi-particle mass, it's just twice. Basically, the quasi-particle mass needs to be renormalized to be larger than twice the bare mass for the mode to exit the continuum. So, you know, in a sense, what we believe is that this mode might be present in several metals, but it's just very hard to detect experimentally.
Doesn't that relation depend on Gaussian invariance?
Yes, so the precise relation is, if you don't have Galilean invariance, F1 will control the renormalization of the quasi-particle mass relative to the transport mass, the one that controls the Drude weight. And this transport mass, in the case of Galilean systems, will equal the bare mass. But in general, it's just the relation between quasi-particle and transport mass. So yes, to be more precise, the quasi-particle mass needs to be renormalized twice the transport mass.
So this mode will mostly be focusing on the element one channel, you're saying?
Yes. These are made out of currents, but transverse.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, this idea is not completely new. So in the 70s, people realized that helium-3 could have this mode outside of the continuum. So if you plug the Landau parameters of helium-3, it turns out that this mode is slightly outside of the continuum. But people tried to measure this mode in helium-3 in the 70s, and the experiments were not conclusive. It's just too close to the particle Hall continuum. But maybe, you know, in metals, there is a lot of them, and the renormalization doesn't seem to be so demanding that maybe the mode is there in several sort of moderately interacting metals. So I'm almost out of time. So, you know, when you solve the kinetic equation with collisions, you find actually a very rich structure of collective modes. So, you know, at zero temperature, basically, there is no collisions. So what I described so far is the zero temperature limit. So if you turn on collisions, just to understand what happens at weak temperatures for the mode and in the presence, of finite temperature that is giving collisions between quasi-particles, you will find the following structure of collective modes. So if F1 is smaller than one, the transverse currents behave purely diffusively. So there is a diffusive mode. It lives completely in the imaginary axis. So this is a plot of the particle Hall continuum in the complex plane. So the eigenvalues are allowed to have real and imaginary part. So you find a collective diffusive mode for the transverse current. So below F1, you know, if you prepare the liquid initially with some transverse current, the currents just decay very slowly, diffusively. But when F1 is larger than one, basically there is two branches of collective mode. So one diffusive one, this red one, and then there is a propagating branch that is this shear sound. So in a sense, in a system at some small temperature, in order to see the mode, you have to probe at beyond certain wave vector. The mode starts at certain threshold of wave vector, but it should be there even in the presence of collisions. And so as I said, you know, the challenge is to measure it. So just to have this a bit short, just to give you the essential idea.
So in the small Q lift, it remains diffusive, even when F1 is larger than 1?
Exactly. So at very small Q, there is no mode with real part. There is two modes in a sense. This red line is a diffusion mode.
So this mode exits the particle continuum only of beyond some critical Q vector.
Yeah, so strictly, like if I just solve the kinetic equation, I find three type of solutions. So there is a particle Hall continuum that is this green triangle. So you know, it's like if I'm not looking at imaginary parts, it just has the same shape of the old particle Hall continuum, but it's shifted by some amount gamma 2, which is the collision rate. And there is two collective modes. One lives strictly in the imaginary axis, which is this red line. That's a diffusion mode. And then there is a mode that appears only at some specific Q. So it starts, this is meant to kind of start here going up in energy. So it does exist only beyond some Q at finite collisions. And this Q is shrinking as you lower the collision rate. So as you lower the collision rate, you go back to this picture, which is just basically the projection of that. So all of that is happening at very small Q. So how could you measure this mode? This is one proposal. So you know, basically the idea is the following. So at some frequencies, the liquid is responding like a solid, right? So imagine I put some solid, like just imagine I have some kind of particles joined by springs, and I am trying to pass this solid through some channel, trying to force this solid to move back and forth within some channel, okay, with some external electric field. Then the friction will act predominantly at the last particles, the ones that are touching the boundary. So, you know, then because of this friction, the liquid will feel some net force that is transverse. Right, if you plot the net force, meaning the applied force plus the friction, it will have some derivative along the x direction, the force along y. So it's a small transverse self-consistent force that the crystal would feel from the friction of the boundaries. So the crystal will try to oscillate in this transverse fashion. So then when you hit the resonant condition, that when the frequency equals, you know, the velocity of the sound times the Q defined by the width, then you will get the minimal sort of harmonic of motion. And so what we did was to solve the kinetic equation, including, you know, collisions, boundary scattering, and lambda parameters. And this is a plot of the real part of the conductivity of the liquid as a function of frequency for two cases. So the blue line is when F1 is larger than 1, and the orange one is when F1 is below 1. So the orange one and the blue one have a cusp at the particle Hall continuum, but the blue one develops these resonant zeros, okay? So this plot is in the limit of no collisions in the bulk. So all the collisions are happening at the boundary. So what happens in a sense is, because there is only friction at the boundary, the liquid sort of resonantly pins at the boundary. It's trying to respond like a crystal. So it resonantly pins at the boundary, and you don't have dissipation. It's only the bulk what is moving. So if all the collisions are coming from the boundary, the resistivity goes to zero. So the imaginary part is finite. So that means, you know, the liquid is moving. It's just moving without dissipating. If you start turning on momentum breaking collisions inside the strip, then these dips start going away gradually. So this blue line here is for this L is the mean free path. So then when the mean free path is 5 times the width, it's still there, but when the mean free path equals the width, then the dips are not that clearly visible. They're just barely there. So basically the condition is you need a very clean sample But if it has this mode, and you are in the regime in which the width is smaller than the mean free path, you will see this resonant dips in the conductance. Another strategy is to turn on a magnetic field. So when you turn on magnetic fields, there is a mixing of this mode with the density. So it has actually charge fluctuations. So this is a plot of the density-density correlation functions as a function of frequency and weight vector. This is the zero sound, so the zero sound has a lot of weight on the charge. This is the particle hole continuum, and this is the shear sound mode. So it acquires a little bit of weight on the density when you turn on a small magnetic field. So this could be a way to also excite this mode, turning on weak magnetic fields and doing some type of, you know, local type of near field optics way to excite collective modes, like in plasmons in graphene, for example. Yeah, so that's basically the story here. You know, metals can, certain metals, when they are sufficiently strongly interacting, can sustain a shear collective mode. And this mode, the experimentalist might be able to see it in very clean narrow channels, and maybe also by turning on weak magnetic fields.
So, as you crank up the value of F1 from small to large value, is there a phase transition at 1?
A phase transition? Yeah, no. So, from the ground state properties, no. So, you know, the Pomeranchuk happens at minus 1. So, yeah. This is going in the other side.
Not symmetric breaking transition, but is there any non-nonlinearity?
Yes, that's a very good question. Yeah, I've wondered about that. So I want to say, you know, there is no phase transition in the static correlation functions from the point of view as defined as correlation, static correlation functions. But in a sense, dynamically, there is a kind of phase transition in some sense.
In the collision list limit, because you have this new collective mode.
Yeah.
Whose energy goes all the way to zero energy.
Yeah.
Even the equilibrium property might be modified.
I think because, you know, what happens with the Fermi liquid in a sense, and this is in a sense why it remains like free fermions, right? Even in the presence of collective modes, is that the static correlation functions are dominated by the particle hole continuum. So if you take correlation functions in which you take, you know, the limit, the limit of omega goes to zero, and then the limit of q going to zero, you will be dominated by the particle hole continuum. So I suspect that even if this mode exits, all the static correlation functions will look like a Fermi liquid. But how you approach the small omega q limit, if you approach the small omega q limit along some other directions, you might see different behavior. So you, particularly clearly, if you approach it along the dispersion, you will see a very different behavior. So in the dynamic correlation functions, there is information that there is a sharp change, but not in the static correlation functions, is what I would like to say.
For statics, if I look at density of state, if I go to something,
density of states.
Not a conflict.
But you mean like a specific heat?
Yeah.
No, I think it will be dominated by particle hole continuum. Specific heat will, I'm almost sure, doesn't have anything. This will give like a higher power to specific heat.
Yeah.
I see, you're trying to say higher power.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's basically like if you do the expansion of the Fermi liquid, right? It will have an X power besides
T.
So then it's a change of that coefficient, yeah. I think static is, my feeling is that there is nothing static, low energy that
shows
up.
Question is there any non-nonlinearity?
Yeah, could be higher.
So leading or sub-leading.
Yeah. No, that's a very good question. I've wondered about this, but I believe there is nothing in the static correlation functions. But in the dynamic correlation functions, in a small q and omega, there is a sharp change. So in that sense, it's a kind of phase transition if you are allowed to include, you know, dynamic correlation functions in your definition of a phase, let's say.
But usually dynamical correlation function that goes down to zero energy affects some equilibrium properties.
I agree, but you know, that's typically when you have like a few collective modes. If I had a phase of matter that was like, you know, a superfluid versus a solid, right? They have different number of collective modes. Then I think I see that, you know, if there is one more collective mode, you'll see different static correlation functions. But in the Fermi liquid, in a sense, because you have this infinite number of collective modes, the static correlation functions, I think, tend to be dominated by this low-lying collective modes that are in the particle Hall continuum. Because it's not just that they have lower energy, it's just that there are an infinite number of them, right? Yeah, but this is a very good question. I this is how I feel about that question, but I don't want to say I have like a, you know, very rigorous proof of this statement, yeah.
Let's thank you again.